Well, good evening and welcome to the third presentation in this, our seventh series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum. We appreciate your forbearance for our slightly cramped conditions, but as Sue Lynn said, a testament of a good funeral is how many people show up. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the orange, Peggy Wright, and with help from our website guru wandering around taking pictures, Hai Wan Wan, and our reference coordinator, Brian Carson. Daniel Peach designed our posters, and Jennifer Wilson, wandering around, handled publicity. Our speaker tonight is one of WKU's most published faculty members, whose tales of ghost stories from Kentucky and Tennessee, and whose Halloween readings have made him a legend in his own time. He's a native of Rockbridge in Monroe County, famous for its blood feuds and killings. And after graduating from WKU, he received his MA and PhD from Indiana University. And after a stint at Campbellsville College as a professor and administrator, he joined the faculty of WKU in 1969. In 1972, he founded the Folk Studies program, one of the few in the country at the time. And during three decades, he taught several generations of students and helped promote the program as one of the most prominent and unique in the country. He wrote his first book, The Saga of Crow Ridge, which was published by the University of Tennessee Press in 1970. He's published 22 more since then, with such enticing titles as Ghosts Along the Cumberland, Killings, Spoke Justice in the Upper South, and Haunted Houses and Family Ghosts of Kentucky. In 2003, he began publishing the results of research among Kentucky and Tennessee professionals with Tales from Kentucky Lawyers, followed in 2005 with Tales from Tennessee Lawyers, and Tales from Kentucky Doctors in 2008. He's received many awards over the years, and in 2001, he was inducted into the Kentucky Music Hall of Fame, and 2 years later was honored with the Governor's Award in Folk Heritage. He's a frequent consultant to museums and government agencies, and here to tell us stories from his newest book, Tales from Kentucky Funeral Homes, and perhaps even a ghost story or two, please welcome everyone's favorite storyteller, Linwood Montell. Linwood?
Now, what are you supposed to do when you've got a crowd like this? I think I'll just take off my coat so I won't get too hot. It is good to be here, and I do appreciate all of you coming. It just makes me feel plumb good. Now, I'm supposed to tell three or four ghost stories tonight, and I think I'll start off by telling one that's not really, it's not quite a ghost story, but it's almost. And what it is, my sister, about 6 months ago, she asked me, would you be willing to go to Louisville with me, because I need to look into the possibility of enrolling in a beauty college up there. And I said, you want me to go with you? She said, well, yes, I'd appreciate it if you would. And I said, well, okay, let's go. And so we got in the car, went up there, and it was on a Saturday, and we got to the beauty college, and by golly, it wasn't open. And I looked across the street behind us, and I saw there a museum just across the street. And so I said to her, well, let's go down across the street here to the museum, and if it's open, we'll go in there, and if it's not, we'll just stare in the window, you know. And it may be that eventually the beauty college will open up. And so we walked across the street, and it was closed also, the museum was. But we looked in the windows and all of a sudden, about two blocks down the street, some woman down there was looking at me just like that. And I said, lady, why are you staring at me like that? And she says, can I come a little closer? Well, I looked at my sister and I said, well, come on up if you want to. And she got within about a half a block of where we were standing, And by golly, she stopped again and just started looking at me like that. And I said, why are you staring at me like that? She said, because you look to me like that you were a German Shepherd dog in a previous existence. And I said, a what? She said, a German Shepherd dog. Do you mind if I come up, she said, and put my hand on your shoulder blade there just to simply see what it will tell me? And so I said, like that, well, come on up. And so she walked up and she put her hand right here on the shoulder bones. Oh boy. Now she wasn't a ghost, but I guess I was almost one. Okay. Should I wait and tell the ghost stories at the end?
Yeah.
Let me start out by simply sharing two or three stories from each one of one is Tales from Kentucky Lawyers. And it came out, I don't know, back around 2002, 2003 or 4, I don't know exactly when. But it's got some wonderful stories in it. And these are all stories that were told by lawyers and judges across the whole state of Kentucky, just like the one on the Kentucky doctors and the one on the funeral homes that we'll be talking about later on. And so what I tried to do was to cover every portion of the state. I didn't try to cover every town or every city, naturally. It wouldn't have room in the book. And so, anyway, these lawyers shared some great stories with me. And on the back of this book, a ghost got that other book, Press decided to put this story on the back of the book, just to attract people's attention, I guess. And so, what it says is, this lady was called into court one day, and the judge asked her, now, lady, is it true that you had sex with a hippie on top of a motorcycle in a peach orchard on June the 23rd. And she thought for two or three minutes and said, what was that date again? I love humorous stories. Now, this is another humorous story. It came from a lawyer over in Beattyville, Kentucky. Says, Alvy Holland of Hazard told me about a case. Some years back, they had a system of appointing a defense lawyer for someone who was poverty-stricken. The court had appointed this legal assistant to be the lawyer for a woman in a severe case. Well, they went to court, and the Commonwealth attorney appeared that day. He had brought the assistant with him, so they got started in the trial, and the woman said to the judge, Judge, I want to say something. The judge said, well, stand up and say what you want to say. She said, I want me another lawyer. The judge said to her, well, Mr. Doe is a fine lawyer. He has a good reputation, so I've appointed you with one of the best. She said, nope, I want two lawyers. He asked, why do you want two? She said, they've got two on the other side, so I want two, because when one of them is up there talking, the other one is thinking. But when my lawyer's up there talking, they ain't nobody thinking. And here's one from Madisonville, a very short one. We had an elderly judge in district court here in Madisonville several years ago, and this woman went to court and took her 5-year-old kid in the court with her. The judge was sitting up on the bench, and he had on his robe. The little kid walked in and looked way up there sitting up on the bench, and he asked his mother, Mama, is that God? She said, no, but he thinks he is. Okay, let me share one more lawyer story. And this one came from Pikeville, Kentucky. I don't know whether you'd call this a lawyer story or not. It involved a prominent client in Pikeville by the name of Oliver Anderson, who is now dead. He was one of those persons who was a little bit on the shady side, but everybody liked him, and he had a tremendous personality. One time he hired somebody to burn his house down, and in order to provide himself an alibi, he got up a bunch of people and went down to a high school basketball game. There came a lull in the game or quiet time in the gymnasium during the ball game. All of a sudden, the public address announcer said, "Paging Oliver Anderson." Oliver jumped up in the midst of all those people and hollered out, "Oh my God, my house is on fire." And that is a true story. Okay. Don't step on my glasses, Case, because my glasses may be down in there. Now let's go into the doctor's storybook. And it's the one down here on the ghost floor, Tales from Kentucky Doctor. And I love this book also. Before my grandfather, who was a doctor, had an automobile, he made house calls on a horse-drawn buggy. Now this comes from Princeton, Kentucky. The horse was special. He seemed to have some homing pigeon in him. Grandfather would go to the house call that would sometimes be at night. When he was finished making the house call, he would get the horse started home. Then he would lean over and fall asleep in the buggy, and the horse would pull the buggy all the way back home. Sometimes he would be miles outside of town, and he was known to have been seen asleep with that horse just walking down the road on its way back home. And here's one from Owensboro. A friend who was a physician here in Owensboro but has since moved out of town told me a story about why he wouldn't wear a tie anymore. He had been accustomed to wearing a tie in the office. He says that one day he was seeing a patient and he had his tie on, but he did not have his coat over it like you typically do. He was in the process of doing a rectal exam. And as he started to do the rectal exam, he noticed that his tie got stuck on his finger, and it was used as part of that rectal exam. And he said, because of what happened, he did not wear ties anymore. Now this doctor told me, he said his father was a doctor, and his grandfather was a doctor there in Davis County. And he said, my grandfather got his license to be a doctor in 1905. And back then, you typically made house calls. And my grandfather, on numerous occasions, he would actually go across the river over into southern Indiana to do house calls over there. And when he would get back home, if he weren't too tired and too sleepy, then he would sit down and write down an account of exactly what took place on that house call. Now, isn't that something that should be done in a lot of business professional people on the things that they do on a daily basis? And anyway, though, he said that his granddaddy gave him over 200 pages of these accounts, you know, that he had written down. And by golly, the grandson who told me this story, he literally gave me about 35 copies of those stories that his grandfather had written down, and many of those are in the book, Tales from Kentucky Doctors. I've got to share two more with you, and then I'll get into the funeral stories. This is one of my favorite stories in the doctor story book, and it's about a fella from Pike County, Kentucky. He had never been out of that county. And he was 19 years old. Well, let me just read it. I'll tell you about a young man who came to see me the first 10 or 15 years I practiced in Pikeville. I saw an awful lot of coal mine accident injuries, including a lot of hand injuries. This young man, age 19, had been injured in a mine 2 days before and had a broken finger, a badly unstable broken finger that needed repair. Here's hoping that'll help a little. He told me that he had been in the emergency room 2 nights before, and they had just taped his broken finger to the next finger and told him to go see another surgeon in town the next day. The other surgeon was not of the mind to do any hand surgery, which is tedious, so he referred him to an orthopedic surgeon, a hand surgeon in Lexington. Now listen to this. The young man came back to me later after he had been up there in Lexington. And when he got to me, he said, "Doc, I got up there in the edge of that town, and I saw all them big buildings and all them cars and all them there people. And Doc, I ain't been out of Kentucky before. And so I come at home. So just do now what you can for me. But he literally thought that he was out of state when he got to Lexington, Kentucky. And now let me tell you one more. This is a story I forget who told me this, but it's a doctor's story. He said, I don't typically go into my office on Saturdays, but on this particular Saturday morning, I had gone in. And 30 minutes after I got there, I got a call, and I could tell it was an elderly lady on the other end of the line. And she said, Doctor, will you be in your office this morning? And he said, yes, I'm here already. Do you have some need to come in? She said, yes, my husband is very poorly, and he does need to get your attention to see what you can do for him. Well, he said, bring him right on in. I'll take care of him. So 30 minutes later, they showed up. He said, when they got there, I took the husband, the sick man, back into my office, and I spent 25 minutes just simply checking him out and seeing what I could do for him. And when I got through doing what I could do, I walked back out into the waiting room with him, where his wife was out there waiting in the waiting room. And when we got out there, I said in a joking way, oh, by the way, Bill, how's your Viagra doing these days? And his wife jumped up and said, if he's taking Viagra, he ain't using it at home. I hope I don't embarrass my daughter and son-in-law. Okay, now Tales from Kentucky Funeral Homes. Due to the insightful historical content of orally transmitted stories, I fully realize that funeral directors' accounts should be included given the fact that they are the final persons to care for friends and community members when death occurs. Their memories needed to be preserved in print so as to retain significant historical data relative to their early years and contemporary times. I began the story recording process in November 2007 with those persons who willingly shared their memories. The stories I was able to record from funeral directors throughout the Commonwealth tell about their personal practice across the years, consisting of the following topical categories, and I'll read some of this in a few minutes. They talked about historical insights into the funeral profession, old-time burial practices, old-time burial customs, humorous accounts, personal practice, ancestral parental practice, funeral customs, and then other funeral directors, mistakes, premonition stories, funeral practices across the years, and even miscellaneous stories. I chose two primary criteria as service rationale prior to making contacts with potential storytellers. First, they should typically be middle-aged or older, as they would likely have more interesting, memorable accounts to share, especially if they had ancestral funeral directors that founded family funeral homes. The second justifiable reason used in selecting storytellers was that they should be practitioners in small to medium-sized towns or cities located in all sub-regional portions of the Commonwealth. Thanks to references and or contents made in my behalf by funeral directors whom I had just interviewed, I was able to interview and record stories told by insightful persons in Simpsonia, Owensboro, Lewisburg, Litchfield, Morgantown, Bowling Green, Brownsville, Glasgow, Fountain Run, Tompkinsville, Somershade, Hardinsburg, Elizabethtown, Louisville, Bloomfield, Campbellsville, Shelbyville, Mount Vernon, Irvine, Pineville, Moorhead, and Ashland. Because what I tried to do is to cover, as I said, every portion of the state. And what was amazing to me, not only with the funeral directors, but with the lawyers and doctors also, when I would tell them that I was working on a book, you know, and they would say, well, now you need to call so-and-so over, and they would give me the name of the person in the town, and I'd say, well, give me the telephone number, and I will. And by golly, several times, when I literally called that person whose name and telephone number they had given me and told them who I was and what I was doing, they said, oh yeah, so-and-so called me already and told me that you'd be calling him. And so, I mean, they really helped me gather stories that I came up with. Okay, in chapter one of this Funeral Homes book, the historical insights into the funeral profession. Rather than actual stories relative to the funeral profession, the descriptive commentaries in this chapter provide insights into the way death matters were dealt with in earlier years and changes that have taken place in more recent times. Definitions of terms such as funeral director, embalmer, mortician, coffin, and casket are included, along with the various types of public services performed by funeral home workers. One account claims more funeral visitations took place in a small rural town than in the large city of Louisville, given the fact that everybody knows everybody in the rural area. And that was actually, he was a funeral director up in Lebanon, Kentucky. And it's a very interesting historical town, but I understood what he told me, because he said people do know people, and there's even some country songs along that line, is there not? Now, old-time burial practices, typically set in the days before electricity and indoor plumbing, these tales about early burial practices portray the role of family and community members in helping with, even doing, family funeral preparations and burials. Perhaps it should come as no surprise that lack of funeral expense money was a reality, yet funeral directors understood and were willing to wait until payment came later on. Sons often help their funeral director fathers prepare for funeral services and burials. Also, in earlier times, there were horse-drawn hearses, handmade caskets, and by the way, back in earlier times, they were called coffins, but most of the time, but they're now caskets. And the early embalming often took place at home, which included putting the body fluids in buckets. Even family members were given permission to help with the embalming process, which often involved pouring the deceased blood into the hole in an outhouse. So they took the blood out of the body and took it out to the toilet and just poured it away. Okay, old-time burial customs is the third category, the third chapter. A folk custom is a typical practice or habit of behaving in accordance with family and community traditions. Since these matters are generally known and practiced, they typically are enforced by social disapproval when violations take place. As indicated in the brief number of stories herein relative to the funeral profession across the years, it was typical for community members to dress dead persons' bodies, dig graves, use the term coffin rather than casket, provide homegrown flowers for grave sites and Memorial Day purposes. As a matter of fact, the custom of placing floral tributes on family graves is still a form of ritual behavior. People still do that. And let me just say this. I told somebody earlier on tonight this, but when I was a little boy, my daddy, he was not a funeral director, but my daddy was the kind of person that he would help anybody in any way that they needed help. And so whenever a dead person, that is whenever a person in the community passed away, he would get a telephone call. Willie, so-and-so died, would you come on over and shave him and dress him and get him ready for burial? And my daddy would always do this. And something else that's not in my book, I don't think, but something else that he said, that many times, just to be sure that the person's eyes would stay closed, that he would put a quarter on each one of those eyes. And he said, by golly, it is amazing how many times when people, as they were passing by, and when they got through passing by, the quarters were gone. Somebody literally had taken the quarters off of those eyelids. But the old-time burial customs, the chapter, it is simply so interesting to me. Oh, here's a category of humorous funeral tales. Some of the stories in this chapter may or not be humorous when reading them, but hearing them when they were told by funeral directors helped demonstrate the director's need for personal condolence, especially when in grief-stricken situations. Humor is a state of mind, thus funeral directors need to utilize humor as a means of helping them work through sad situations experienced by relatives and friends of the deceased who are present during funeral services and burials. funeral director tales featured herein include long-winded preachers. Uh-oh. Some of them made weird, humorous comments. Caskets also not properly loaded with a dead person's body. That's other stories. Dead person's body making movements in the casket. Mechanical problems with caskets at the funerals. Bossy funeral directors. Pranks and humorous words utilized by the rector. A live young man pretending to be the dead body. Drunk man that fell into the grave. Accidental and or intentional use of incorrect words, humorous and or stubborn actions and words by family members at funerals and ceremonies, and one story about God's involvement in a piddling process. Okay, I'll simply just tell you this without reading any more comments. In chapter 5, these are personal practice stories in that chapter. And that's a very, very important chapter. And then chapter 6 is ancestral and or parental practices back in the days before the coming of funeral directors. And then chapter 7, funeral customs. And that goes also back to the old times as well as, in many cases, present times as well. And then chapter 8, a chapter about other funeral directors. And those are good stories too, because they don't mind telling you stories about other funeral directors as long as they don't typically have to use the name. And then chapter 9 is simply mistakes. A chapter on mistakes made by these funeral directors. And then chapter 10 is premonition stories. And there actually are stories that were told by people who experienced some sort of a significant something, you know, that told them that so-and-so was going to die. And so things like that. And I love those stories because they've been passed on for so long. And then chapter 11 is funeral practices across the years. And chapter 12, miscellaneous stories. And now then, let me read you one, a story. This one comes from Fountain Run, Kentucky. Do you know where Fountain Run, Kentucky is? Now, I've got to tell you a story about Fountain Run High School, nothing to do with funeral homes. They had a high school back in the 30s and 40s and 50s, and every time they played anybody in basketball, their cheerleaders would get out on the court at halftime and give this same yell. Now, let's say they were playing what was then Alberton High School here in Warren County. Those girls would get out there and they would at halftime and say, "Fountain Run, Fountain Run, what a team!" "Alberton, Alberton, what? A team?" And I've asked a lot of cheerleaders, why in the world don't you start using that yell? Because it's not offensive, it's just cute. And I think it would be good to use that at these school games. Okay, but anyway, Connie Hughes Goodman over at Fountain Run, she's a funeral director in her father and grandfather's funeral home. "When my grandfather started Hughes Funeral Service, they ran an ambulance service along with a funeral business, and those stories we'll have to keep for another time. In those days, the mortician would come to the home of the deceased and do the embalming there. The corpse would lay in state at the home until after the funeral, in which the body was taken to a graveyard for interment. Grandfather took his instruments to the home in somewhat of a doctor's bag. He used a hand pump to inject the embalming fluid. That was before the days of electricity and indoor plumbing. My grandmother assisted him by doing the pumping. When that was finished, it was pumped into a bucket. And my father says he can remember having to dig a hole about 2 feet deep by using post hole diggers. And the body fluids were then deposited in the hole." Now they used to do that a lot. And I love this one from E-Town. It's the lady that sometimes faked a faint. "We used to have a lady that went to every funeral that we had. She was here just about every time we had a funeral. Every time she went to a funeral, whenever we passed the crowd around to the casket, she would always pass out every time." In most cases, she wasn't a part of the family, but she would walk with a casket and look in, carry on, and pass out right in the middle of the floor. And sometimes we thought it was sort of a put-on. We saw her doing that so much that we'd be there somewhere pretty close to try to catch her to keep her from hitting the floor. Anyway, we just simply got tired of doing that. And one day we said, well, what we're going to do is to let so-and-so just hit the floor. And we did. We let her hit the floor. And she didn't break any bones, but that was the last time she ever did that. And this one is from Summershade, Kentucky, in Metcalf County, over near Greater Downtown Rock Bridge, where I'm from, in Monroe County. The funeral profession, like the doctoral profession, demands that these people have got a lot to learn. They've got a lot to learn and respect. My dad earned a lot of respect from his dealings, which kind of rubbed off on me. However, I don't reckon I ever had a fight during a funeral that I know of, but if there's any family friction, it always comes out during the funeral. This happened not too long ago. A fella had been in the hospital down in Bowling Green, and he died down there. He wanted this chaplain to conduct the funeral, and the chaplain got over to talk with the man's wife, and she said, "There's one thing, chaplain. He lived his life the way he wanted to, and I respect him for it. So I don't want a long eulogy delivered. So one thing, preacher," she said, "if I stick my finger up, it's time for you to shut up." I don't know if the widow stuck her finger up or not, but the preacher didn't stay up there very long. I was standing there when she told him that. She wasn't up to sitting there for an hour and a half listening to somebody talk for so long, as she was tired riding back and forth from the hospital, but her comments were certainly unexpected on this part. Now, here's a story I'm going to tell you, and it's about the preachers. And this funeral director told me this. He said, I had a funeral at a service once at a church. And he said, by golly, there were five preachers there, and each one of them wanted to give a eulogy and or maybe just preach, you know, a brief commentary. And he said, by golly, that when the first one got up there, it took him 20 minutes to get through. And the next one got up, and he felt like he had to outdo the first one by 5 minutes, and so he spent 25 minutes doing his. And the third one got up, and he spent 30 minutes doing his. And the fourth one spent 35 minutes. And the fifth one got up there, and he didn't quite get through, because the funeral director said, by the time he got ready to just about finish, there were only two people in the whole congregation. That was that preacher and me. He said everybody else had got up and left. Oh, boy. And this one came from Lewisburg, over in some place called Logan County. Anybody here from Logan County? Ooh, doggy. This is Bryson Price over at Lewisburg, and he said, we've got a friend who runs a funeral home in a surrounding community. They'd had a death call, and for some reason or another, I don't think the deceased person's family had brought in his clothes all at one time. Later on, they brought in his suit coat, and I think it was a blue pinstripe coat or something pretty common. The men that worked there at the funeral home had come in and asked the secretary if the family had brought their clothes in yet. Well, they had finished bringing them in, and the secretary says, yes, it's a blue suit hanging up in the office over there. So they went and got their clothes and went up to the embalming room and dressed the body and put it in a casket. They were getting ready to have the body out for visitation, but they were also going to have a funeral that same day for another person. When it came closer to funeral time, the funeral home owner had gone into his office. When he came back, he asked, has anybody seen my suit coat? Well, come to find out, they had put his coat on the deceased person. I'm not sure how that ended up that day. I don't know whether he had to go through the funeral without a suit coat on, or whether he just went home to change clothes and then come back. This one, John Phelps from Bowling Green told this story. We had a visitation in this funeral home 10 or 15 years ago. Jean Vaughn, who is a colleague here, is married to Evelyn, who is a real Southern lady. She has only good things to say about any and all people. She was opening the front door for people as they came in, and there was a brother and sister that walked in. And just as they got to the door, the elastic in the sister's underwear broke and her panties fell. She just stepped down, picked them up, and put them in her purse. Looked at Evelyn and said, "Well, I've never had that to happen before." Evelyn looked at her and said, "Neither have I." The point of this story is the understatement of the century. When they got ready to leave, she looked at her brother and said, "George, have you got your hat? Don't lose your hat." She had lost her panties, but she was worried about his hat. And this one is over from Pineville, Kentucky. And boy, he told some good stories. Bob Walden related to me about some of the ins and outs of snake handling churches. One of them was that seldom do they actually come to the funeral home and handle servants, part of that being that it is not a felony in the state of Kentucky, but it is a misdemeanor to handle servants. Well, the law enforcement is pretty easy when they're having service at the church, but when they have them at public places like the funeral home, sometimes the law can get a little testy about certain things. He was relating to me the story about the untuned guitar case. He said, when they come into the funeral home, you watch all the guitars getting tuned up. And if there's a guitar case that does not get open, that's the case the snakes are in. And you want to be sure to watch that case to make sure that what comes out or goes back out doesn't stay in. Okay, this one is from over Salem. I think that's it's either in Graves County or either Davis, one or the other. We were having a viewing for a man an hour or so before the funeral service was to be held. Among the family members, there was some disagreement about what is called a clip-on tie. One of the grandchildren proceeded to go up to the casket and rip the clip-on tie off of his grandpa, and then run out the door with it. Some family members ran after him, but I don't know whether they caught him or not. But when the 8 pallbearers, who were all grandchildren, came up to view their grandfather for the last time, each one of them took off their clip-on ties and placed them in the casket before we closed it. And let me say this before I share another story or two, then I'll shut up. But did you know that back around just before the turn of in other words, in the 1880s, 1890s, up into the early 1900s, up in Cincinnati, they literally had a coffin factory that when they made coffins or caskets, they literally placed glass in the lid of the casket, because when it was turned over on top of the person's face, you know, and it missed it like breathing, you know, in other words, they got on that glass, they knew that that person was not really dead. And so they literally made those and sold them everywhere. But now, of course, they don't do it because of embalming and all of that. Now, this one is not a very acute religious story, but it is. This story goes back to Dwight Smith, from John Phelps again, and the ambulance service. Dwight told me this story right here in this funeral home. He had picked this young man up who had been shot and was in really bad shape. His mother rode in the ambulance with him, and she was telling Dwight to drive faster. Dwight looked at her and said, "Miss Mary," that was a pseudonym, "the only thing left to do for you is to pray." She said, "Well, Dwight, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pray. And when she began to pray, she said, oh, Lord, you need to come yourself. Don't send your son. This is a man-sized job. And here's another one. Well, two more. This one comes from Campbellsville. One time the local hospital called me five times in one day to come pick up the same person that had been pronounced dead five times by the licensed physician. And every time he had come back to life before I got there. So that got to be a joke, as you can imagine. I never did know the story of that, but I told them the last time when they finally did say he was dead and I could pick him up, I said, well, do you think I should have a hammer with me just in case something happens and he comes back to life again? But he didn't come back to life again. He stayed dead that time. Okay, this is the last one from Lewisburg again. There was another funeral director who weighed at least 350 pounds plus. His casket display room was upstairs in his funeral home. He was making arrangements with the family, and they got ready to select the casket. He started up the steps to lead them up there, and the further he got up the steps, the lower his pants were coming down. By the time he got to the top of the steps, his pants fell completely down, and he was standing there in nothing but his boxer shorts. That was an embarrassing moment for him. I'm sure the family got a big chuckle out of that. I suppose his pants fell all the way down to the ground before he could catch them. Okay, do you have any questions about the funeral homes book? It's only been out about, I don't know, 14 or 15 weeks now. But it is a good-selling book, and I was going to bring it. Is Barnes & Noble, are they here tonight?
They are here around the corner, yes. We'll be having a book signing after this. Yes.
Okay, and so anyway, if you want to buy a book, by golly, I'll autograph it for you. And I'll only charge you $84 a piece. But since you've been so nice as an audience, I think I'll charge you anything. Do you have any questions? Yes.
I have a question. Did you find anything when you were getting these stories about differences between ethnic groups here in Kentucky? Because there is a huge segregation issue amongst the funeral directors.
Well, there was a black lady in Louisville who shared some things with me that shows that there was a feeling of a difference and what have you, but she said overall it was very good. And also, some of the stories in this funeral home's book does focus on Mennonites and Amish in some instances. And so basically all portions and all different types of ethnic groups are all included one way or the other in the book. Because that's one thing that I try to see to, is that simply that it's not an all-white book, for that matter, you know. It has to be females as well as males, black as well as white, and the list goes on. But I'm just not a person who is inclined to just to focus on simply what most of us are in this room here tonight. And let me tell you a story. Simply, it's not a funeral homes book. But when I taught at Western, I taught one course. It was called Cultural Diversity. And I would have usually 8 or 9 or 10 black students in that class each time. And somewhere during the class, that is during the semester, I'm talking to all of you. How many fingers do you have on your right hand? How many toes do you have on your left foot? How many eyes do you have? How many ears do you have? Okay. Tell me this now. How many of you have red blood in your body? And it was the same response, you see. And I said, that just goes to prove one thing, that color does not make one single bit of difference in our lives. I said, because we are all God's creation. And in one instance, one semester, five female black students stood up and gave me a standing ovation. Because we just need to treat everybody that way, regardless of what ethnic group they're with or whatever, you know. Any other questions about even the lawyers or doctors? Or yes?
Oh, are you going to tell us a ghost story?
Oh, And I'm going to tell you a true ghost story. That is, told to be true. And this is one of my students at Western in 1982. And she was from the city of Louisville, or Louisville, whatever you want to pronounce it. She was from Louisville. And she came into my office one Wednesday morning, and she said, "Guess what happened to me this past weekend?" She said, "My two friends from Louisville, they had been married a little while, and they each one had a job in Lexington, and they proceeded to buy an old deserted house, very historically interesting, and they proceeded then to get the house renovated. And it took about 3 months to get it done. And when they got the house renovated, they called me and asked me, would you like to come over and be our overnight guest in our newly renovated house?" And she said, "I was thrilled to death." And I told them, "Yes, I'll be there. I'll be there about 3 o'clock the Saturday afternoon." And she said, "I got over there between 3 and 4 o'clock, and we sat down and started to talk, and we just talked and talked and talked and talked, and finally it came time to eat dinner, and we sat down and we ate, never stopped talking, and even when we got through eating, we continued to talk until 10:30. And finally, the husband of the other girl said, "Listen, I can see we're all getting tired and sleepy. It's time to go to bed." And she said, he said to me, "Now, your room is up the stairway upstairs. It's the first door to your left. That will be your room for the night. We sleep down here." And she said, I got up and I walked up the steps and I opened the door to that room, flipped the light switch on, and because nobody was up there but me, I didn't even close the door behind me. I just walked over there and took off my clothes and put on my night clothes, and about the time that I got ready to go over and flip the light switch off, she said, "I heard rocking out there in the hallway. Rock, 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 rock." And I raised up in bed. Actually, the light was already off. I raised up in my bed and looked out there, and it was the rocking chair rocking to and fro of its own accord, but there was no one sitting in it. And then suddenly, whatever it was, I could hear footsteps coming into my room. And breathing, "Oh my gosh," she said, "you can't imagine how labored, how painfully that breathing sounded." And then whatever it was walked to the foot of my bed and put his hands, apparently the hands, on the mattress and mashed down really hard, and I could feel the pressure exerted there on the mattress. And then, by golly, I heard footsteps again. It was walking around to the side of the bed. And that breathing, I could sense it bending over, looking at me. And that breathing was, oh, it was horrible, absolutely horrible. And suddenly, the hands of the, whatever it was, mashed down on the mattress so hard that my body literally rolled over into the cavity created there in that mattress. And I kept thinking, she said, I kept thinking, what in the world is happening to me? And she said, I crawled up out of that hole in the mattress and got up on the other side of the mattress, you know, where it was still solid. And by golly, I heard whatever it was walking around to the head of the bed. It was a foot and a half between the head of the bed and the wall. And when he got around there, she said, I sensed it bending over the bed, looking at me. And breathing, oh, that breathing was so painfully horrible. And she said, it scared me so much that I literally turned over on my stomach, pulled the covers, every quilt on that bed, over my whole body, and I even put a pillow over all those quilts even. And then I felt a searing stab right between the shoulder blades. Oh! It's going to kill me right here, whatever it is. And in about 10 seconds, she said, I felt another searing stab right between the shoulder blades. Oh, what am I going to do? It's going to kill me. And it did it again, the third time. And then she said, I heard the walking leaving the room The breathing was less pronounced, and I heard the rocking chair out there squeak, 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 squeak. It had gone back out there and was simply rocking there in the rocking chair. And I felt so good that I was still alive that I did not scream out for my friends downstairs. The next morning, though, when I got up and went down there, I asked them, what in the world happened to me up there in that room last night? And the husband of the other one said, tell us what happened. We don't know. You're the first overnight guest we've had in this whole house. And so she explained what it was that happened. And because something had made her think that she had been killed, he said, I'm going to go down to whatever office you would go to. I'm going to go down and check on the death certificates. And by golly, he came back at 10 o'clock. That was on Monday morning. He came back at 10 o'clock. And he said, guess what? A man's body was found in the closet, stairway leading upstairs. And he was dead. And guess how he died? And she said, no, you don't need to tell me he wasn't. He butted in and he said, you're exactly right. He was stabbed 3 times between the shoulder blades. And now that is told to be an absolutely true story. Most ghost stories are told to be true, but I don't try to prove or disprove them. I simply just record them as what is told by the local people. And so with that one, I guess I'd better shut up.
Well, on behalf of WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum, our friends organization, our genial host, the faculty and staff at the Kentucky Library and Museum, we want to especially thank Linwood Montell for gracing us with a Halloween presentation.
Every night for the next year, if you'll come back.
And Barnes & Noble is here with copies of Tales from Funeral Parlor, so if you'd like to buy a copy, Mr. Montell's going to make his way there around the corner and just as you enter the museum. We also hope you'll join us and chat with Professor Montell. We've got refreshments, cider, and Halloween cookies for the occasion. We hope you'll be our guest next Kentucky Live series when Bob Dickey will be here to talk about the history of Beach Bend.
What is that?
That will be the first Thursday, be the 9th, I guess, of November, right? Barnes & Noble.
November 5th?
November 5th. Thanks very much and good evening.